Welcome back, everybody, to Story, Symbol, Spirit, a podcast on how to make sense of scripture. My name is John McCambridge, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host.
I'm Jackie Mitchell.
Jackie, as we record this, we are approaching Easter weekend.
I know.
And so it's going to be released the Monday after Easter.
The Monday after Easter. So happy Easter, guys.
So happy Easter to everybody. So we're a little frazzled right now, getting ready for the weekend.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
You know, one thing that they don't tell you when you come and you work for a church is that manual labor is required.
Yeah, I'm a little sweaty right now from setting up tables.
Yeah, because like it's not like intense manual labor, no. But like, you know, sometimes you have to move like 400 chairs and there's like three people.
Yeah,
there, right.
Yeah, so. And I'm weak enough that that is intense manual labor for
maybe for you. Although you've been working out.
I moved five tables and I'm like, no, that's true. I've been strength training to put more chairs away. Yeah. In this church is the reason.
Because during your review, I said that you were way too slow with putting chairs away.
You're way too weak. You're good at your job, but you're way too weak.
What's your, what is you and Josh's tradition? You know, how long have you guys been married? 3 years now?
3 years now, yeah.
What's kind of like your Easter weekend tradition? You guys have one?
Yeah,
other than being here.
Yeah, we're here. So we're here usually. We play. We both play in the band, so we're here. And then we usually go up to Toledo to Josh's family. We do like Thanksgiving and Easter with them. But they're going to come down now that we have a house.
Oh, nice.
This is the first year. So they'll be at the services. And then I don't want to do a whole ham. So I think I'm just going to do like brunch. Everybody loves brunch. Yeah, and bacon's close enough, you know.
Yeah.
That's pig
same
still.
Animal, right?
Yeah. What about you guys?
So what are you thinking about putting together? Like, what do you mean brunch? Just like
I'm
going
to do, pancakes
and
pancakes. And
I've had a pancake for
a long time. I might get crazy and do crepes instead of pancakes and do like a berry compote and stuff.
Ooh.
I don't know. Maybe if I'm feeling crazy.
Wow.
Fancy. But bacon, eggs, and then that's it. Yeah, you swing by. You and Jenna just show up ready. Hey, we're here.
Can I have some of those pancakes real quick? And stay for like 5 minutes and leave.
Do you guys stay in town or are you going anywhere?
No, we stay in town.
Yeah.
It's just like too
much. It's kind of
like,
hard when you,
Christmas and Easter, it's too much to like leave. Like
I know
people can do it and they do it even if they work for church. But we usually just stick around. So she will have like a brunch with her mom and stepdad and brother. And sometimes, depending on what time they get reservations, sometimes I can make it to that. Sometimes I can't.
Sometimes you're invited.
Yeah. And so maybe we'll go to that. And then we usually get together with a couple friends in the evening and kind of like celebrate Easter. And
that's fun.
Finally pop some champagne.
Right.
What I told Jared on the Rest podcast that I did.
You were a guest on. You really were podcasting
week.
It up this week.
Yeah. I'm very in demand. I don't know if you know.
Oh, you're booked. So, you're booked a lot.
Yeah.
Glad you could swing by here today.
Yeah. Well, you booked Thank it early you. Enough, so I came by. But what I was telling him is N.T. Wright, who he's an Anglican bishop. Our former Anglican bishop. He's just like a scholar, like an old grandpa. Right?
He's very British, like the way he talks.
So
very
British,
like,
so proper, so educated.
I know.
And he always says that we should all be drinking champagne on Easter. And like what I told Jared was like, it's not like you look at this guy, N.T. Wright, and it's like, he's not like he's walking around popping bottles all the time, right? But he's so serious about the celebration of the resurrection. He's like, if champagne is a thing,
we better get
we
it
should
out
drink it on Easter, right?
What so, other occasion so maybe,
yeah.
than Easter?
So maybe Sunday night with our friends we'll have some champagne.
That's so funny.
Besides that, not a ton. So we will have gone through a week of prayer nights here, which have been great.
So good.
Which you play great. At. You,
yeah.
You're up there playing the keys. Like a little bit more of like a spontaneous worship situation, right?
Oh yeah.
So I have no idea how that works because I don't understand
you
music.
You stay in the same key the whole time and you figure it out. It's hard to make that much of a mistake when everybody's singing in the same key.
Yeah.
You just stay in one key the whole time and whoever wants to sing whatever kind of happens.
So these nights are cool because, you know, it's like you just come into a space and the space that night is dedicated to prayer and worship. And I'm hoping to make this like a meeting that we do every Monday.
Yeah.
So probably not Easter Monday, but then maybe after that.
Yeah.
One of the things that's been cool about like the band is I keep telling Matthew and Daniel, I'm like, no, like literally it would work if only someone had an acoustic guitar.
I know.
And everybody wants to be there.
We
want to
be there.
Cool.
I mean, it's fun. It's a good night.
So we'll have had four nights of that, then Good Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have an Easter service on Saturday night.
Yeah.
And then we have two services Easter Sunday morning, right? So we probably will be a little worn out. It's been quite a week for us.
There's no youth night though. So I'm looking forward to Sunday evening.
Yeah. So, but that also means that now not only are you responsible for brunch, you're probably responsible for dinner too.
Oh, now I'm sending people home.
Yeah. You could like take out.
I don't know what we're going to do, but I don't think I'll cook. So I'll be asleep at like 6 p.m. Easter.
Yeah, there we go. Well, I think today's episode should be relatively brief. This is a pretty famous story.
Yeah.
It's not particularly complex.
No, it's pretty straightforward. It's like, you know what was wrong, what was right.
It kind of points you towards some stuff, but you haven't really dug in yet.
Yeah.
And so last week, we looked at that crazy episode of Judah and Tamar.
Insane. Crazy episode.
Which I would say like it was somewhat resolved, but not completely. And so...
But it
was
like the better resolution would be for none of the initial issue to occur. So it's like, it's a resolution, but like it's still reeks of sin all around.
It's a very human resolution, right? And so basically Judah's son, dies.
Mm-hmm.
What the Bible says, because he was evil.
Yeah.
Wicked. And then his wife, Tamar, had not yet had a child. And so according to the law, which we haven't seen yet, but apparently has been revealed because it was discussed, there's something called levirate marriage where the brother is supposed to carry on the deceased brother's name by marrying his widow.
Mm-hmm.
And the child that they have together will be, in terms of his name, will belong to the deceased brother.
Yeah.
Right. And so that, and the reason that the law says that is so that his name will not be blotted out in all of Israel.
Yeah.
And so we talked a little bit last time about how important that is to, you know, family lines, lineage, tribes, all that stuff. So after dies, the next brother, Onan, refuses to do what he's supposed to
do.
And so he dies as well.
Yeah.
And so then Judah promises Tamar that he'll give her the youngest, Shelah, when he is of age.
Uh-huh.
And then he'll perform the levirate vow and give her a child. But it seems like maybe Judah thinks that Tamar's cursed. Both his sons died. And so he doesn't actually intend on giving her Shelah, the youngest. And once Tamar realizes this, what does she do? What's her strategy? Well,
she dresses up as a prostitute and like basically disguises herself. And Judah comes by and is like, oh, let me sleep with you. She's like, okay. And he gets her pregnant.
Right.
Yeah.
And so then... when it's revealed that she's pregnant, what's his judgment?
He thinks she should be killed because he doesn't put the two and two together. She kind of does this crazy, like, oh, well, the guy who got me pregnant owns this staff, this seal.
Right.
Can you recognize it?
Right.
And he's like, oh, that was me.
And so Judah like kind of repents.
Kind of, yeah.
Right? Where he at least, it says that he doesn't lie with her again.
Yeah.
Right.
He at least admits that he's wrong.
And he admits that he's wrong. Yeah. And he takes back, you know, his judgment, even though that was not a righteous judgment in the first place. And so Tamar gives birth to twins, Perez and Zerah, right? Yeah. And so we will come back to them at some point. But all this drama kind of makes us forget the drama that happened before.
Yeah. We kind of got left off at like a crazy cliffhanger and we almost forget.
Yeah. So two chapters ago, what happened?
Joseph's brothers sell him into slavery and he's gone. And then his dad, you know, Jacob's... He's distraught. He refuses to be comforted, and that's kind of where we left off.
Right. So one of my themes for specifically what happens with the sons of Jacob is, am I my brother's keeper?
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which was the question that Cain asked God, and you had mentioned a quote where it was basically like the rest of the Bible shows you that yes, you kind of are.
Yeah.
So when you think about selling your brother into slavery,
probably not keeping him,
not being a good brother's keeper.
Thumbs down.
How about refusing to perform the levirate vow to keep your brother's name alive?
Thumbs down.
Thumbs down, I'd say. Right?
Not as well. No.
And the way it's written in the law, if you refuse to do it, you're basically like you're killing your brother because you're killing his name.
Yeah, you're killing off his namesake. Right?
And so, so we go back to the story now about Joseph, who was sold to Ishmaelite merchants, Midianite merchants, Midianite merchants, some kind of conglomeration of Ishmaelites, and. They in turn sell him to one of Pharaoh's official, Potiphar.
Potiphar.
Who is the captain of the guard.
Yeah. Right?
So very high ranking official. And so we kind of pick back up at that chapter. So this is kind of strange in Genesis that we sort of like, we're like these cut scenes, right? Where it's like, now we're with Judah. Now we're back at Joseph. And like you.
It's so cinematic.
Seems like it would have made more sense to just like keep going with the Joseph
story.
No,
I know, but it's so cinematic. Yeah. I like it.
And so now let's pick up with Genesis 39. We'll just do the first verse and get oriented.
Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there.
So Potiphar is the chief of the guard or the captain of the guard. And this means that he's in charge of lots of things, including the jail.
Hmm.
the king's jail. So that will become significant here soon,
yeah.
Right? And I think that's why this is just kind of mentioned here. And it's also stressed, you know, that we see this sometimes where it's just randomly stressed that Potiphar is an Egyptian man.
We're like, yeah, we know.
So he's taken down to Egypt and he sold to Potiphar, an Egyptian.
And you're like, right? Yeah, okay.
And of course, like we keep saying, the Bible does this on purpose. And so why? What would be like a good guess as to why the Bible in this moment decides to emphasize that Potiphar's Egyptian?
Yeah, kind of an emphasis on if you're in the family of God and if you're not, if you're a Gentile, if you're a Jew, right?
Right.
This is kind of like, are you in the covenant family
right.
or are you outside of the covenant family?
Yeah.
So this is kind of stressing that he's not, he's a Gentile.
Right, exactly. And so what we're going to get to at the end of this story is that there's a very specific relationship between the covenant family and the Gentiles. Mm-hmm. And it's actually not supposed to be one of hostility.
Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be one of blessing, right?
Blessing, right. And so we're going to get to that. But by stressing that Potiphar's an Egyptian, basically stressing that he's of the nations.
Yeah.
Right? Not God's family,
mm-hmm.
covenant family, mm-hmm. okay? And so we'll get to that. Let's do 2-4.
The Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him, and the Lord gave him success in everything that he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant.
Mm.
Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned.
So the first sentence here that you just read is a pretty good summary of the entire episode.
Mm.
Yahweh was with Joseph so that he prospered and had success in everything he did.
Mm.
That's what the story is going to be about from here going forward. An interesting discussion around this is like, you know, our tradition that you and I are a part of at this church is pretty like I would say we're pretty anti-prosperity gospel, mm-hmm. right? Which the prosperity gospel is kind of this idea that because you follow God, everything's going to go well for you. And yeah. so, you know, it gets dangerous because, you know, when you sign up to follow God, you don't sign up for a program.
Yeah.
So God is wild and free. Mm-hmm. And the way that what he puts into your life, you have no control over.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the fear of submission and surrender to mm-hmm. him, right? Because you totally lose control. And so the idea that like, okay, if I give generously, I will receive money generously. It's dangerous because it's not a formula.
Yeah.
Right? Or if I do the right things, then I'll be materially blessed or whatever is not.
Mm-hmm.
It's not formulaic like that. But there are these moments in the Bible where it kind of seems like maybe you kind of edge up to that line a little bit, right?
Sure. And I also think, you know, Joel did a really good series about like the dichotomy between, you know, a book like Proverbs and a book like Job that mm-hmm. say, you know, although they go together, say very different things. Like you can do the right things that God says you ought to do and it will be better for you.
Right.
Like it's just generally better to handle your finances well, to be honest, to be early to things, wake up, get stuff done. But that doesn't mean that, you know, then everything's going to go right in your life. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, we do see moments where like, it kind of seems like maybe he's living into like just doing well and doing what God's calling him to.
Yeah, because like God set the world up.
Yeah.
It's his world. So if you live according to him, then it kind of makes sense that things will go quote unquote well for you. And if you try to grind against that grain of the world that he created, then it kind of makes sense that life is going to be hard, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there are certain things where it's like if you're dishonest and nobody trusts you, you can have short-term gain.
Yeah.
But then at some point you're going to lose your relationships.
Right,
and
exactly.
And all of that's going to be going to go away. And so it's a little bit more tricky than this, but we do have to see this and see that life with God is supposed to be prosperous.
Yeah.
Right. And how that works out materially is sometimes mysterious, but how that works out in the most important things in life is not that mysterious.
Yeah. I would say it's always prosperous. It's just we have maybe a misconstrued idea of what we think prosperity means.
Right.
Yeah.
Because remember, we're talking about how much Joseph is prospering. He's a slave.
Yeah.
Who was sold by his kin.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's always more complicated than like the, you know, quid pro quo. I do a good thing, I get a good thing, mm-hmm. right? And so Joseph is in the house of the Egyptian master. And just kind of interesting to note and kind of orient ourselves here to what this is. Literacy was very rare in these days. And so Joseph can read and write.
Mm.
And actually his father could read and write. And so he's not a slave, you know, who's going to do hard labor. Remember that slavery is not necessarily just to take people and punish them. It's to take people and make them do things. So if you have the capability of doing high-level things, then why would they make you go out there and build pyramids, right? So he's put into the house of the master. And it says here something interesting at the end. His master, Potiphar,
saw that Yahweh was with him, right?
That Yahweh was with him. It's kind of interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that his master saw that Joseph prospered, but very specifically, his master saw that Yahweh was with him. So it's kind of going to be interesting about the story is that Potiphar is actually one of the good guys in this story.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of seems like maybe he has like some degree of, you know, conversion might not be the right word, but
maybe
some
like reverence.
Yeah. Respect for, for his God. When you and I did the Jonah thing, story, right?
Yeah.
When they find out who Jonah's God is, they're all pagans. They don't worship Yahweh exclusively. But when he says who Yahweh is, they know who he's talking about. And they're like,
then they're afraid.
Why have you done this to us, right? And so you see this sometimes in the Gentile nations. They know who Yahweh is, or at least some of them do. And he sees that this God is with Joseph. And so Joseph is put in charge of Potiphar's household, which becomes important. And so the question is, you know, if Joseph and his family is the carrier of the covenant, how is all this going to tie back into to the covenant that was given to Abraham and carried through his offspring? And so let's do 5-7.
From the time he put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So Potiphar left everything he had in Joseph's care. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except for the food that he ate. Now Joseph was well built and handsome, and after a while his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me."
All right, so the Lord blesses the household of the Egyptian.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Because of Joseph.
So Joseph is certainly blessed, but why is the foreigner blessed?
Because that was God's promise to Abraham, right? That the nations would be blessed through his family.
Through his family, right? Yeah. So the nations are blessed because they're tied into the covenant family somehow. And so you're right. God tells Abraham, you will be blessed and your family will be blessed, and then you will become a blessing to the nations, to all of them. And so I actually think that part of this story, and really part of the rest of Genesis, is where we see some of this start to come to fruition. We start to see some of the sprout, the promises to the Gentiles. And so the Gentiles blessed because of God's covenant people.
Yeah.
And that was always the missional charge of the family of Abraham. And then there's this ominous statement at the end. So all is going well, but everything's in Joseph's charge. But then Potiphar's wife demands that he come to bed with her and sleep with her because he's well built and handsome.
And handsome.
And so an old school translation of this is fair of form and fair to the eyes.
Mm.
And so I don't know, do you remember somebody else who was described as fair of form and fair to the eyes?
His mother.
Rachel.
Got those good genes passed down.
Yeah. And so it's the only other time this Hebrew phrase is used.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one of the things I think that they want us to remember is that they want us to remember that this is Rachel's son. Because it kind of gets confusing. It's all these boys. Some of them are coming from, you know, surrogates and who's who and what's the order. And it's all very confusing. And so, you know, we just talked about Judah, who is not Rachel's son.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're back to Joseph. And so I think maybe this line that was used to describe Rachel does play into the story's narrative, but I think it's also there specifically to draw our attention back to the fact that, that Joseph is Rachel's son. And Rachel was Jacob's favorite wife, right? His first wife.
It's the one he wanted.
The one he wanted. So here's a theme that we've been coming back to over and over again, the temptation, right? And so we're going to get into that. But this is, in fact, a command from the wife, who has her own slaves, which we're going to see here in a second. So she has a degree of power, and she commands this of Joseph, who is a slave. And so there are certain power dynamics here that are going to be very tricky, other than the fact that it's a temptation, right? Yeah. So let's do 8-10 and see how it goes.
But he refused. "With me in charge," he told her, "my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything that he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her.
Look at that. The first sentence, but he refused.
Oh.
It's like the first time that we've seen Jacob's sons having good character, right? I mean, like...
This is like the first good decision from the sons. Yeah.
And so I do think that in terms of reading the narrative, we're supposed to like see that and be like, oh.
Whoa.
This story is going to go different, right?
Because we've just read so many stories of like, oh, and this guy did some awful thing.
Just think about what Judah just did, right?
Yeah.
And so he says, I have been given everything except one thing.
Mm.
What does that remind you of?
The garden.
Okay. So what did they say in the garden?
You can eat from any tree of the garden except for this one.
Right. You have anything in my house except what?
Just my wife.
Yeah, my wife. And so it's kind of interesting. The final reason that Joseph actually says that he won't sleep with her is not just because of what Potiphar's given him, but because of what?
He won't sin against God.
Sin against God, right? And so this is like, this is I think supposed to be like an archetypal response to temptation, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to do it because it is true that a lot of times sin ruins our lives.
Yeah.
But what is supposed to be the real reason?
Because we'd be sinning against God. Yeah.
That's my king, right? And and I've given my allegiance to him, and so I won't do that. But it does seem like, you know, she doesn't really give up.
And she keeps going.
She keeps trying to seduce him day after day.
Jeez.
But unlike the failed test in the garden, and mostly all of the tests we've seen so far with Joseph's forefathers and brothers, there's been some good moments, but none quite as like stark as this, right? Joseph passes the test.
Yeah, he keeps saying no.
And he refuses to go to bed with her or even to be with her, it says.
Mm.
And so let's see how it shakes out. Let's do 11 through 15.
One day he went into the house to attend his duties, and none of the household servants were inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. "Look," she said to them, "this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house."
So he's actually like physically attacked here.
Yeah.
Right? She grabs him and demands that he sleep with her again. And it keeps saying cloak here, which is like a fine guess, but the word is just garment.
Mm.
Right? So that's the same thing in the story of Noah, right? When his garment's off. So who knows what it is? Like, it's hard to say, but it's his garment. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that he's like running around naked. It's the reason that I point that out, because it could be any
grabbed a shirt
part
or whatever.
Of his garment. Yeah. But it comes off. And so he runs outside, and it's kind of interesting that this is the second time that his garment has been stripped from him.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Cause what happened? Why is he in this position in the first place?
They took his coat.
Yeah.
Took it off. Took of his him, garment threw him off in a, him. Yeah. Threw him in a pit.
Yep. And that resulted in him being enslaved. And so now another enemy, because before it was his brothers who were his enemy. Now his master's wife does it. And, you know, what does she intend to do with it?
Mm.
Right. And so she tells her servants when they come back in the house that Joseph attacked her.
Yeah.
And she says specifically that this Hebrew has been brought to make sport of us. So that phrase, make sport of us, is a familiar word that we already know, Yitzhak.
Which means laughter, which is Isaac's name. Yeah.
So I think that that's like this is like play on words, right? Like this Hebrew, this son of Isaac came here to make Isaac of us, right?
Mm.
to mess with us. And that's part of the semantic range of this word. And so it's kind of interesting. She actually blames Potiphar.
Yeah, you brought this Hebrew into our midst.
So right now she's talking to the servants and she says, he, right? So he's not even in the house right now. And she says, this Hebrew's been brought to us, right? Well, who brought the Hebrew?
Yeah.
Potiphar, the head of the household, right? So there's kind of like this odd sort of dynamic here, and we're going to see this when Potiphar comes back, where it doesn't really seem like this is like a nice, loving
relationship. Yeah, no.
Which is like pretty normal for these kind of like ancient aristocratic, you know, probably an arranged marriage, some sort of power dynamics. But and so I'm sure that the other servants were also like not particularly fond of this guy who came in and was all of a sudden in charge
came
of everything. So it's probably, they probably resent him, and this is a very good way to get them on her side. So her story is that Joseph got naked or took his garment off and tried to attack her, but she screamed. And when she did, he left his cloak beside her, his garment beside her, and ran outside. So it's kind of interesting. Joseph has been given all this power, but now it seems that he's going up against someone who has even more power because this is the master's wife and she has her own servants and she obviously has her own power. And so the question is, how will God prevail in and through Joseph? So let's do 16 through 19.
She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. Then she told him this story: that Hebrew slave you brought to us came to me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. When his master heard the story, his wife told him, saying, "This is how your slave treated me." He burned with anger.
You know, I heard a really interesting sermon because this, if you notice that it keeps saying his master, his Lord.
Yeah.
And so there's like an element of this that is connected to, you know, our ultimate master, which is God. And I heard an interesting sermon where the guy was saying that we have to be really, really careful about the way that we talk about the church, because the church is God's wife and the church is God's servant, and you do not criticize a servant to his master. And so when we look at other, you know, we all love to do this, right? This expression, this church, this pastor, this thing, we love as people who are a part of a church to kind of like cast our judgment upon them. And I heard in this sermon, you know, this guy was kind of using the wife analogy. And he said, if you come to me with a legitimate complaint about my wife, how's that going to go for you? It's like, well, not well, because that's my wife, right? And it's like, well, what if what I'm saying is true? It's like, well, that's not the point. And so what he was saying was that he thinks that as the church, when we kind of wage critique against other churches, that God sides with them and against us because that's part of his wife. It's kind of an interesting idea. And what you see here is like a false accusation is being given to the master about his servant. And we're going to see how the master handles that, right? And so one of the Ten Commandments is you shall not bear false witness. And like we talked about with selling someone into slavery, bearing false witness against somebody is akin to killing them.
Yeah.
And in this situation, this is absolutely what she's trying to do.
Oh, absolutely. He could have him put to death.
Because what happens when you, you know, if you're a slave and you sleep with your master's wife?
You die.
You die. And it's the captain of the guard, right? He's in charge of crime and punishment in this nation. And so she makes up the story. And like we talked about earlier, she's even in this accusation to Potiphar, she's very clearly blaming him for all this, right? She says, the Hebrew slave that you brought here did this to me. And you know, I think that maybe that's why he burns with anger. Right, there's a weird relational dynamic here. And so the question is he burning with anger? The Hebrew idiom here, which is kind of interesting, is that his nose became hot. So like, you know, like we flare our nostrils when we're mad and we breathe out, you know, it kind of makes sense. But anytime you see somebody was very angry in the Bible, the Hebrew is almost always his nose was hot, including when God gets mad at Moses, his nose gets hot. And so I actually think that perhaps Potiphar is mad. And he's kind of mad at his wife.
Yeah,
I'm not sure he believes his wife, and I'll tell you why I think that here in a moment. But let's do 20 through 23.
Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. But while Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him, and he showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. The warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did.
So Joseph is put in prison. And so like a, you know, a surface level reading of this, you would assume that that means that Potiphar did believe his wife, right? Mm-hmm. And now he's punishing Joseph. But this is the place where the king's prisoners are kept. And so I think I would, you know, what I've read and studied about this is that you would, you know, it's not like it's a good situation, but you would kind of liken this to like modern day white collar prison.
Yeah.
What people call resort prison.
Yeah, the king's prisoners, that's like for the high right. crimes. This is not like just some squabble that someone got into, you owe someone money.
Yeah, because like what would you assume an ancient culture like this would do with somebody who's a slave who raped his master's wife?
You just kill him.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, and probably in brutally. Like
a, yeah, brutal way. Yeah.
Know, like throw him in a pit or bury him alive yeah. or slowly torture him to death or yeah. set him on fire, right? Like, if this happens, you're dead. And so, especially the captain of the guard.
Yeah.
So the idea that he just kind of gets put into this, what's translated prison is like the roundhouse.
Yeah.
And in a position where within the roundhouse, he becomes the warden's right-hand man.
Yeah.
That's kind of why I postulate that Potiphar doesn't really believe the accusation.
This is like his dealing with it for his wife.
Yeah, he can't just say, no, he didn't, he stays, because that's like, yeah. you know, that's like not really feasible.
So this is like the best case scenario yeah. given the situation kind of for Potiphar.
Basically, hey, go live in this prison and run it.
Yeah, and be in charge of it.
Yeah. And so again, like it's certainly not as good of a situation as being in the captain of the guard's house.
Mm-hmm.
But compared to what someone's destiny should be for what he's being accused of,
yeah,
it seems like there's quite a bit of mercy here. And so he gets put in charge of the prison and he finds favor in the jailer's eyes, and God gives him success in everything he does. Does that sound mm-hmm. familiar?
Mm-hmm. Sounds like just earlier in Potiphar's house.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Same language and everything, right? And this is where the chapter ends.
Mm-hmm.
And so Joseph is put in charge of Potiphar's house, and he's blessed by God, and he flourishes, and therefore Potiphar is blessed by God mm-hmm. and flourishes, because mm-hmm. the Gentile is connected to the covenant family. Then this thing happens. He's put in prison because of a false accusation, but in prison, once again, he's blessed by God, he mm-hmm. flourishes, and therefore the prison flourishes.
Yeah.
These other Gentiles flourish. Because that's part of what happens in the covenant family. So wherever Joseph goes, who's getting blessed?
The Gentiles.
Yeah, the Gentiles, which ties right back into that promise to Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is going to come out. We would have just celebrated Easter. And there's a prophecy about the Messiah in Isaiah 49. And so Isaiah 49:6 says, God says, he says, "It is too small a thing for you to be my servant, to restore the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel I have kept. I will also make you a light for the Gentiles, that my salvation may reach the ends of the earth."
Mm-hmm.
And so he's talking about this messianic promise. And because of the exile and the civil war that's going to happen between the north and the south, and then Assyria is going to come in and exile the northern kingdom, and then later Babylon's going to come and exile the southern kingdom, one of the things that they were all waiting for was for the nation of Israel to be regathered.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people, part of the confusion about Jesus was that what kind of seems like is being put out there is that the Messiah is going to regather God's people.
Mm-hmm.
Then we can talk about the Gentiles, yeah. right? And Jesus kind of all at once does something that is somewhat confusing. But this is the prophetic promise that it's too small of a thing for you, my anointed one, to just regather my family. Mm-hmm. You are going to also become a light for the Gentiles.
Yeah.
So in the book of John, I think it's the book of John, there's a bunch of Greeks after Jesus is teaching and doing miracles who come up to Philip and Andrew. And so Philip, the name Philip is a Greek name.
Mm.
And Philip was actually Alexander the Great's father.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so the Greeks come up to the Greek guy. So one yeah. of Jesus's disciples was definitely Jewish in faith, but has some kind of Greek, he has a Greek name. So yeah. some kind of Greek or Roman lineage or blood. And when the Gentiles, the Greeks, come up to Philip and Andrew, and then Philip and Andrew go and tell Jesus what they're asking about him being the Messiah, that's when Jesus says, "My time has come."
Mm.
Kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And so I think it points back to this promise, right? Because Jesus is almost exclusively, not exclusively, almost exclusively dealing with Israel in his ministry. Then he's at this moment, I think it's John 12 or something like that. And when the Gentiles come and ask about him, he says, now my time has come.
Yeah.
Because this prophecy is starting to be fulfilled. And that's really when he starts in the book of John down the track of actually showing himself to be the mm-hmm. Messiah and admitting that that is indeed what he's here. So here we are all the way in the first book of the Bible. And I think that Joseph is like a type or a foreshadowing of Jesus, mm-hmm. the Messiah, because Jesus is the ultimate fulfillment of the promise to Abraham. You and your family will be blessed, and through you, so that's the Jews, and then through you, the Gentiles or the nations will be blessed. Mm-hmm. And Joseph's life prefigures this, right? Because he is the covenant carrier at the moment, and he goes into the places of Gentiles, and they're blessed because of him. Mm-hmm. Even the commission that's given at the beginning of the book of Acts, right? Wait till the Holy Spirit comes upon you in power, and then go and be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea,
Samaria,
which is the lost tribes of Israel, yeah. and then
all the ends of the earth. Yeah.
And then actually the book chronicles how that happens, right? So it's like in that order. So it's like the Pentecost is in Jerusalem, and then they start to go to Judea. And then with Stephen, they're kind of scattered, and you start to see these interactions going out and out and out. And then by the end, Paul, you know, he's headed to Spain. He's in Rome.
Yeah.
Right? He's to the ends of what they know of the earth. Mm-hmm. And so all of this, like, this is why the Bible's so cool. You see that prefigured in Genesis 39, mm-hmm. where when the people of God encounter the nations, the promise to Abraham comes true mm-hmm. when they're faithful, right? Now, we could also treat it like the Levi and Simeon did with the Shechem, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're going to slaughter the Gentiles out of revenge, then the promise to Abraham does not come true. Mm-hmm. But if you're Joseph and you're faithful to God, and you enter into the situations with that kind of faith, then the Gentiles are blessed. And that is absolutely a foreshadowing of what we end up seeing with Jesus. And so coming off of Easter, that's kind of a cool thing, right? Mm-hmm. I can't remember which gospel account, but one of them, it's like the centurion is the one who says, truly he was the Son of God.
I think it's Matthew.
Yeah.
I think. I just wrote it in our reading plan. I don't know. But the centurion and all of his people with him.
Right. Those Gentiles.
Yeah.
Right.
And they all say, surely this man was the Son of God. And they fear God.
Right.
Yeah.
And Paul, a lot of times we don't read Paul like this. Paul calls himself the apostle to the Gentiles, like, begrudgingly. You know, because Paul goes into every city and goes to the synagogue.
Yeah.
And then they reject him almost always.
He's fine.
He goes to the Gentiles and they kind of accept him, at least seemingly at a higher rate of success than the Jews. And Paul, like, I actually think that's why he writes that whole thing in Romans, like Romans 9 through 11 about Israel and the Jews, is because he is, like he says, the Jew of all Jews, mm-hmm. right? A Benjaminite, circumcised on the eighth day and all this stuff. And so Paul is like in despair. He's distraught about the fact that the Jews aren't seeing their Messiah when he preaches the gospel. Mm-hmm. But what he does with that is that he takes it to the Gentiles, right? Which, again, it's too small of a thing for you to just restore the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel I've kept. I will also make you a light to the Gentiles. Mm-hmm. My salvation may reach the ends of the earth. And that's what the story of the gospel is fulfilled in Jesus and the church. And so that's the reality that we now live in. And I think that the first kind of, not the first, but the most clear example that we've been through so far is Joseph.
One of the most faithful characters we've seen so far. Yeah, for sure.
And then you see how the blessings go to him and through him because he's faithful.
Yeah.
And Genesis 39.
Crazy.
And so Joseph is now in charge of the prison. And so next chapter, we're going to see that he meets some other characters in prison. And we go back to dreams and interpretation of dreams and all this crazy stuff. And so I think we're going to get through Genesis this year.
Dude, that'd be crazy. What are we gonna do?
I guess go to Exodus.
I guess Exodus.
Right?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Or you're gonna quit and say, I promised you Genesis. And
I've
so
read
here
enough.
We are. Yeah. All right. Anything else tonight, Jackie?
I think that's it.
All right. We'll have a good post Easter week, and we will see everybody next week on Stories from the Spirit. Mm-hmm.